right. Is that time again? Ronnie still has perfect attendance. Ryan still has perfect attendance. Sam, three absences. Yeah, you'll get extra points added onto your final average. Let me see. Nathan is here. You have two absences. Talon has perfect attendance. Juliana has one absence. Kevin has zero absences. And Deshaun, we're just going to say that you have six absences.
Job that clashes with my class.
Oh no.
You should have signed up for my noon class.
I know. But I wasn't thinking. I didn't know it was gonna be this.
You just keep doing what you've been doing though and sending me emails. Okay. And well, Nolan is here.
We have a fine boy.
You're gonna find him in person. Okay. Don't miss that. Nolan has missed 5 classes. Still got one absence to go.
All right. Papers. Imagine now, imagine later. Papers. Papers are due November 22nd.
Only one of my students at this college got it in early enough to get extra credit. And they are not in this class. But all of you still have to submit your papers. Time is ticking. Friday, November 22nd, by 11:59 p.m. And every single class as we get closer, I'll talk more and more about it. All right.
We left off talking about the Opium War and England's effort to push into China
to take control of fabulous wealth. Wealth beyond quantifying.
And it did so by using drugs. And these drugs, however, were not viewed as narcotics, but rather they were viewed as goods. And under the British system, believing in free trade, they believed they were entitled to rights,
such as being able to sell their goods on the open market. Of course, the Chinese disagreed. This resulted in a war that the Chinese lost. So, they would make a treaty known as the Treaty of Nanking. We went over all of the elements of the Treaty of Nanking. And in the end, that was the first of the unequal treaties that other nations such as France and the United States would push for. But the key was, they all had a term that was set to expire. Which, of course, would make the European powers eager to renew. And we know what they were looking for. Most favorable nation status. But this second Opium War would be triggered by a relatively innocuous event when the Chinese seized a ship that used to be used by pirates. But of course it was sold, bought by a British company, given a British charter, but the license had expired. So the Chinese Marines boarded the ship, arrested several members of the crew, but in doing so, they took the Union Jack, dropped it on the ground, and stepped on it, believing this to be a fakery. But after investigation, the British claims were found to be legit, so they released all but three of the Chinese prisoners, because the Chinese prisoners were actual pirates, gave the ship back. But they did not give an apology for the insult of besmirching the Union Jack. So, what happens? real simple. The British governor
of Hong Kong ordered all of the military ships in Hong Kong to sail to Canton and open fire.
They bombard the port. They bombard the island. They cause huge damage and destruction. They then launch expeditionary forces. Again, like the first one, most of the soldiers themselves were from India. But this time along, they had other soldiers that joined. The French, who had moved into what would become known as Vietnam, sent soldiers to also help invade China. The United States deployed naval vessels to help transport the soldiers. And the Russians sent weapons and ammunition. Why? Well, all of these nations wanted new treaties. Now, it's not even worth going into the details of the individual battles, because it was as lopsided as it was the first time around. In total, Brits suffered or lost 2,300 soldiers killed in action. Another 500 were wounded, so total casualties about 2,800. The Chinese,
over 30,000 deaths and another 20,000 casualties. Again, sharp pointed sticks versus...
This should have ended quickly. And in fact,
the new emperor in 1858,
Xianfeng, would actually sue for peace. Reached out, gave messages
that the emperor wanted an end to the violence.
But, because the emperor was the son of heaven, because the emperor was the son of heaven, the emperor was not going to negotiate directly with the barbarians. No. He would leave it up to his brother, Prince Gong.
Gong would sail to the Chinese port city of Tientsin.
And there, he would meet with representatives of England, France, Russia, and these United States of America. And they would hammer out what became known as the Tientsin Treaties. It's pluralized because I'm going to talk about all four at the same time. Because essentially they were all the same deal. First, all four nations would be able to do something that had never happened before in the history of China. They would be allowed to open up embassies in the capital of Beijing, just outside the walls of the Forbidden City. So embassies in Beijing. The five ports would be increased to 15. So 10 more ports opened up to the Europeans.
And they're now going to be able to go up the Yangtze River. So they're not only just stuck in the ports, they now can enter the interior.
So, embassies in Beijing, 10 more ports, free to navigate the Yangtze River. Four, all foreigners. Not just missionaries. All foreigners can freely travel anywhere in China. Extraterritorial rights. Extraterritorial rights.
So if you break a law anywhere in China, nope, you're going to get punished under the laws of your own country.
And that is the same for the Brits, the French, the Russians, and the Americans.
Lastly,
cash. Britain, who suffered the most, is going to get 6.4 more million ounces or 6.4 million more ounces of silver.
And we said each ounce today is about 40 something bucks, so you can do the math on your own.
And France would get 3.2 million ounces.
Door was open.
3.2. So England gets 6.4, France gets 3.2. Half.
Because they lost about half as many soldiers. Man, this deal stinks, but Prince Gong negotiated and he said, okay, fine. It is what it is. It's the price of doing business. We got our asses handed to us. So he takes the treaties, goes back to Beijing, presents it to his brother, and shockingly, Xiang Fang says, no way! The biggest sticking point? Free travel through all of China. The emperor didn't want the barbarians going anywhere and everywhere in China. So what does he do? He orders his generals to begin military preparations for large-scale military operations, including the fortification of the most important forts in all of China, the infamous Taku Forts. These are the forts that guard the entrance to the Hai River. By which you can sail directly to the capital. As I told you before a couple of times, China is all interconnected by rivers and canals. So it would be possible to sail up the Hai River, and these Europeans could literally sail to Beijing itself. So, we're going to defend these massive structures. We're going to modernize them quickly to keep the barbarians out. Now, FYI, while the battles were going on, the Europeans did actually seize the forts. But after the treaty was signed, they turned them over, thinking that the Chinese were going to go for the deal. Well, the Europeans believed that all was good. So 1859 rolls around, while the Chinese would spend a year preparing militarily, they would attempt to enjoy the new rights that were granted. A British ship starts sailing up the Yangtze, comes within gun range of the Taku forts, and the Taku forts open fire and sink the British ship. At which point the Europeans suddenly realize, okay, the war's still going on. So what do? They prepare a massive invasion, which arrives in 1860. 170 ships, 18,000 men. They're only going for the Hai River. They're going for Beijing.
And how many ships is there? 174.
Sorry, 173.
So here you go. Here is the entrance to the High River. Here is the Southernly Fort. Here is the Northwest Fort. Or sorry, the Northern Fort. And here is the Northwestern Fort. So if you try sailing in, the guns are going to shoot at you from all directions. Well,
the Europeans had already taken the forts once. And guess what they decide not to do?
They don't sail the ships and try attacking the forts. Instead, they launch men and send expeditionary forces, which literally would crawl over the back walls of the fort and quickly seize the forts again.
Once the forts are knocked out,
the contingency begins to sail up the river. Well, upon learning this, Prince Gong quickly comes downstream and agrees to meet with the British
representative. In charge of the diplomatic envoy was Harry Parks. Well,
they meet in the tent. They're in there talking through translators. And then
according to legend, rumoredly so, Parks said something that the Chinese viewed as insulting. So the Chinese soldiers seize Parks and the entourage and quickly races inland and brings them back to Beijing. They would be put on trial. And some of them were found guilty. And guess what their punishment was?
Death
by what? Death by 1,000 cuts. Slow slicing. What the Chinese would do to people is they would have an expert who would
take the person who would be strapped up and cut off a slice, a little chunk of flesh. Agony of getting like your skin peeled off. They would then treat it. They don't want you to bleed. Then they do another chunk. And then they treat it. They don't want you to bleed. And they would do another chunk, and another chunk, and another chunk, and another chunk.
Guess what's eventually going to happen to your body? Why?
Because you don't have that layer of skin protecting you from disease.
Well, no, not only that, but in the moment,
you're going to pass out from pain.
You're going to pass out from systemic shock. Because your body can only handle so much trauma. But eventually, the skin is going to give way to muscle and fat, which eventually is going to give way to bone. And eventually, they're going to cut off so much that you do, in fact, die. It usually would take about 12 hours.
Some Chinese torturers were really good, and they could keep the person alive for a whole day.
Well, here's the thing. They killed British representatives.
There's rude.
The British were pissed. So they would send a message to Beijing. Their gunboats quickly sailed south, sailed up the Yellow River, came near Nanking, in open fire, and they would completely level the Summer Palace,
which was as large and as opulent as the Forbidden Palace, which is technically the Winter Palace. The distance from the river to the Summer Palace was the same distance from the High River to the Winter Palace. The emperor was in Beijing at the time. This was a warning sign. We're coming for you next. Qian Fang
was so freaked out, he actually fled the capital and went further into the interior of China, leaving his brother as regent to negotiate.
Well, Prince Gong knew this time we had to agree to everything the Europeans wanted. For real this time.
At what is known as the Peking Conference, although I'm using Beijing because that's what we call it today. But back then it was called Peking.
The British, the French, the Americans, the Russians, they all sit down at this conference. And China formally accepts the Tientsin Treaties. So everything you've already covered, they're going to accept it.
But there was an extra addition.
And this was in the British Tientsin Treaty. Under the terms that the Brits would get, British ships would be given a monopoly, or the British would be given a monopoly to carry coolies to America. What's a coolie?
What has not happened in America yet?
Oh, slaves. It's slavery.
Coolies are essentially what we would call slaves. But here's the catch. The coolies themselves were captured not by force, but by threat of violence to their families. So gangs would capture a guy's family, hold them under threat of death, unless the guy gave himself up for sale. The catch is, the coolie would come to an America, get a wage, but would then have to send the money back to the gang to keep the family alive. If the payment did not come, there goes the family. Now, by the way, the first coolies came over as indentured servants. So they made a contract where they agreed to work for somebody, and they would get a little bit of money, and they sent the money home. After the end of the Civil War, the United States passed the 13th Amendment, which abolished all forms of servitude. Did it stop the coolies?
Nope.
No, because they never technically were owned. In American law, even after the 13th Amendment, they were viewed as employees. Because who is actually being held against their will? Not them. Their family. And where?
In
China.
Guess what coolie labor contributed to the construction of?
The wool? No.
The transcontinental railroads.
Is that a role in America?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. They also came over as laborers, A lot of them came over and worked, the women came over and worked as prostitutes in a lot of the mining camps. And by the way, if there's, what the heck is the movie? There's a documentary, it's on, it used to be on Netflix, called like General Gao's Chicken. And it actually tells the story of the fact that this is still ongoing today. All of the waiters and waitresses that work at the big Chinese food restaurants, they're not here of their own free will. They are essentially, they live in, you know, housing that's owned by the company, and they get put on vans and they're delivered to the Chinese restaurants where they work.
But it's perfectly legal in the United States. Well, how do you like, how do you think you would stop that from happening?
Can you?
You have to stop it.
Seems like it's pretty hard to do.
No, you can't stop it. The only thing you could stop is say, okay, no more Chinese migrants coming in.
Right. But then it's like...
Well, yeah, in today's society, oh, you're a racist, you're a xenophobe, because you don't want the Chinese people coming in. No, we don't want slavery coming in. We don't want human trafficking.
Right. They're also communists, so...
That's true, they're chi-coms. Yeah, they're also spying on us. I mean, the whole weather balloon, you know, buying up ag land in the middle of the country. Oh, yeah, we our politicians have sold us out to the Chi-Coms.
Yeah, right outside of military bases, too.
Yeah.
Piece of shit.
Yep. All right. Now, here's the thing. We have to be honest. As bad as what the Europeans did to the Congo, for example, or what the Europeans did to the Ottoman Empire, these opium wars were catastrophic for the Qing dynasty. They caused so much destruction that there was little that they could do because the Europeans would set a precedent. And I'm only going to talk about these two wars, but there would be a half a dozen other wars that occurred between 1860 and 1890, in which whenever the Europeans wanted more rights, they would instigate a war, kick the living snot out of the Chinese, and force the regime to give them more terms. So much so that the Europeans, by 1890, had 90 ports open. And they started creating spheres of influence. So they took the land and controlled parts of the land without controlling the whole country. And other countries joined in. So the Brits were there, the French were there, the Russians were there, we were there. But soon the Italians came in and the Germans came in. The Portuguese came back, the Belgians, the Dutch. All of the Europeans were doing this and there was nothing the Chinese could do to stop it. So that put the dynasty on the brink. And it would culminate in two series of events. The first, rebellion. All of the different rebellions that were sparked by the Opium Wars, hands down, the Taiping Rebellion was the worst. The scale of destruction is unimaginable. Because almost all of southern China would erupt in this, impacting the lives of hundreds of millions of people. And it all was started by one man. Huang Xuguang. Hong Xu Guang. And who was Hong? Well, he was an aspiring scholar gentry. He would attempt to take the Confucian exams because he wanted to get a government job in which he would basically be set for life. But he did not pass the exams. In fact, he failed it several times. After his third failure, he had a complete breakdown. Suffered depression, almost on the extent of being clinical by modern standards. He basically isolated himself from his friends and his family. He almost committed suicide. But at some point while recovering, he had a vision. While in his vision, he would learn that he actually has a celestial family, which was different than his earthly family. His family included a heavenly father, a heavenly mother, a heavenly elder brother, even a sister-in-law. He actually also had a heavenly wife and son. But he couldn't make sense of it. So then he goes and takes the exam the fourth time. Puts himself back up, you know, straightens his mind out, goes back to study and tries again. And he failed a fourth time. At that point he realized, I'm not going to do it. So he started wandering. And apparently, and by the way, this is after the first Opium War, he comes in contact with one of the Christian missionaries. And he gets pamphlets. He talks to the missionary. He learns for the first time in his life about this Christianity thing. And he was absolutely convinced after several years, he finally understands that vision. The celestial father,
God.
The celestial older brother, Jesus.
He also came to believe that Jesus directed him to rid the world of demon worship. So, based on his interpretation, he became committed to putting forth a purge of Chinese society. Because he literally believed he was the younger brother of Jesus. So he began to preach. By the late 1840s and into the early 1850s, he began to gather not just a small set of disciples, but a literal army of followers. And these followers were encouraged to essentially engage in jihad, holy war, or crusade, whatever term you want to use. These Taiping fighters were lethal because they were fighting for a cause to save the earth. And ironically, they won a series of sweeping victories against the Qing army, which had gotten its ass handed to it by the Europeans that was not really getting paid. And the soldiers were just like, whatever, they really weren't committed to die for the regime. The Taiping actually even had women fighters, known as Hakka. And by 1853, they carved out a huge swath of territory, which Hong would proclaim to be the heavenly kingdom. And that's what Taiping stands for. The heavenly kingdom. They would seize the city of Nanking. They would make that their capital. And at its height, Hong ruled over 50 million people. So, a huge chunk of China is just taken out. Plus, the Europeans are attacking. Plus, you have the unequal treaties. Plus, you have the demands of paying all this money. Plus, you have the army not really willing to fight to death for the emperor. The dynasty is on the brink of complete collapse.
couple of things would happen that barely saved the dynasty. The first, Hong became convinced that he could easily conquer all of China. But he did not have the men nor the resources to do it. So the further he drove north, the more and more his forces suffered what militaristically is usually referred to as a quagmire. They got bogged down and casualties started increasing. Why? Well, Hong and his commanders began plotting against one another. They quarreled over objectives. Some killed one another. Some outright quit. It was just bad. Plus, many of the people that Hong controlled were really not liking what Hong was preaching. Because Hong preached a form of communism. He claimed that there was no private property. That all property was to be shared communally. He called for equality of women.
He called for the destruction of the traditional philosophies, Confucianism, Buddhism,
Chinese folk religion, ancestor worship. Get rid of all of that with his version of Christianity, in which he is the Son of God. He also imposed lifestyle restrictions. No more smoking opium. If you got caught smoking opium, you would be killed on the spot.
No drinking. You had to wear a particular style of clothing whenever you were in public.
No sake?
No sake. That's Japanese. And interestingly enough, his weird form of Christianity was so varied that even the Christian missionaries start quitting on him. Because they believed it was going to his head. And
he also triggered a counter-rebellion of sorts.
Because Confucianism, as we covered the last time we were through in China, is essentially the core values of Chinese society. And here this guy is basically saying, get rid of it. 2,500 years of culture and tradition gone because he says so. Plus, Confucianism, there is no economic equality. Remember, there's the relationships based on superiority and inferiority. There's no gender equality. Men good, women bad.
And the Taiping had no respect for traditions and values.
They smashed tablets and they smashed shrines. They literally leveled family shrines. So what ended up happening? Well, this was seen not just as a rebellion against the dynasty, but this was seen as a rebellion against Chinese culture itself. So even though the soldiers didn't want to fight and die for the emperor, a resistance movement began, a counter-revolution that would be led by not the imperial government, no, but by the provincial governors, the scholar gentry. The Confucian scholars. They, at a provincial level, so at a state level, would begin building their own armies that would be loyal to them, not the emperor. And they would use their armies to attack the Taiping. The most powerful of them was Zheng Gufang. Zheng Zheng Guofeng essentially implemented kind of like a draft in his province. He trained his soldiers using European military advisors, and he made all his soldiers take an oath to him. He essentially became a warlord. And as other scholars saw what he was doing, they began doing the same thing. They formed a loose-knit alliance, and they began attacking the Taiping in all directions.
It was Zheng Guofeng himself who was credited with stopping Hong's drive towards Beijing.
Drove the Taiping off the battlefield and sent him retreating back to Nanking. By 1864, the warlords invaded the so-called Heavenly Kingdom and essentially conquered all of it except for Nanking, the capital. And in the summer of 1864, they would lay siege to Nanking, and over 100,000 Taiping warriors would die in the siege. Interestingly enough, Hong himself died because he decided to invoke a vision. So he thought he was going to eat some hallucinogenics, but what he ended up doing was eating poison weeds. So he killed himself.
But in total, over 20 million men, women, children, 20 million
would die in this, which historically speaking is one of the deadliest military conflicts in all of world history. Think about it. The total casualties in World War I was about 11 million. The total casualties in World War II, not including civilians, not including the Holocaust, not including what Stalin did, was about 15 million. So in this one war, 20 million just died. We're not talking about those who were injured.
Well, if you cannot control your empire, and you allow invaders to invade and rebellions to rise up,
do you deserve to remain on the throne? Well, here's the funny thing. There were many in China that said, yes, but we need to fix things. So similar to what the Ottomans would attempt to do, to reform, to modernize, calls began going out around China for what were known as self-strengthening efforts. And I'm going to give you the first one because it was quick, and then we'll come back and talk about the second one next week. The first attempted reform is known as the Dongxi Restoration. The Dongxi Restoration.
What's that mean?
Dongxi was the emperor who succeeded his father, Xianfeng. So Xianfeng got his butt kicked in the Second Opium War. Well, he died in 1864, and he would be replaced by his son, Dongxi. This movement would be led by Zheng Guofeng and other warlords, because they learned, look, if you bring in forward advisors, you try getting modern weapons, you use modern military tactics, you can actually start winning wars. And if you can win wars, you can crush rebellion, and you can maintain control.
Their goal was actually to open China to foreign investment. So don't allow them to make spheres of influence. Don't allow them to colonize. No. Let's do business with them. Let's bring in their money. Let's have them use their capital to build factories and railroads to increase production.
Let's do it like they're doing it in Europe.
Let's modernize our military forces. Instead of sharp-pointed sticks, let's use rifles. Let's use modern artillery. Let's have our soldiers wear uniforms.
But, unfortunately, the Dongji Restoration would fail. The reason is complicated. Some of the government officials, when they heard the proposals by Zhang Feng and other of these provincial leaders, were like, I don't think we can pull this off.
This is going to take money. We're not going to invest this money. Because what happens if it doesn't work?
Then they'll lose money. So we're not even going to try. Plus, Chinese are racists. They've always been racist. They always will be racists. Because, as I've used the phrase before, they considered anyone who's not Chinese a barbarian. And they still do to this day. So why are we going to act like the barbarians? We've never in our long... They could trace their origins back thousands of years. Why are we going to be like the barbarians?
Plus, these reforms were being suggested by the provincial rulers. Because truth be told, the emperor at this point really wasn't controlling all of China. The warlords had control over their domains, and there was nothing the emperor could do to them to stop them.
And ultimately, lastly, it would be this warlordism
that would stop the efforts to save the country. Because when the warlords got told, meh, by the regime, they decided, some of them, to modernize their own provinces.
So interestingly enough, at the provincial level, there were some provinces that began creating their own modern armies, that began making modern military bases, that started making munition plants, that started buying modernish naval vessels. But they were loyal only to the warlord. So when the nation would go into problems, it would be up to the warlord to decide, do I want to get involved or not? And most of them were like, nah, we're good.
Questions?
Hold on. We had a whole bunch of people come late because apparently 1 o'clock means different things to different people. I want to make sure everyone's here. So Josh, you came in late. As of this point, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you have 8 absences. You're 2 over the limit. Don't miss any more because your average is going to get crippled come Christmas time. Maxine is over. She's not here. Caden, you missed last class.
I got called to court.
Oh, that's right. You had the legal issue. You told me about that beforehand. So that we will call that a pre-approved absence. Kevin, Michael, you came in today. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You have 7 absences. You're 1 over, so that means at least 3 points coming off your final average. And for every absence after that, 3 more points are going to come off. Don't miss any more classes. Andrew, did you come in late last class?
Yeah, I did.
I thought so. You have 1, 2, 3, 4 absences. You still have 2 to spare. Who also came in late? Oh, Baptiste. Baptiste, you have 5 absences. You're 1 away from the limit. If you miss 1 more, you're good. If you miss 2 more, 3 points are going to come off your final average. I think I got everybody else. Last thought, papers, don't forget. Take care.